This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, Simon Dingle has written a book, and I'm very excited to talk to him about this because he told me about it 2-3 months ago, and he is currently working on Invest Capital and Phantom Design. He has been a part of the teams that built 22/7, Curve, and Luno, three of the best fintech apps in South Africa. He speaks at a number of events about blockchain, cryptocurrencies, design, business trends, innovation. He's also a broadcaster, writer, and speaker who tries to make complex subjects simple for people like me. So he's been working with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies since 2011, way before it was cool, Mubs, designing products that make it easiest for us to engage with this new world of money. His new book is out. It's called In Math We Trust, and he's on the line. Hey, Simon, how are you?
Hey, Gareth. Good, and you?
Good, man. Well done on the book.
Thank you so much.
I finally got my copy, and I've been breezing through it. It seems to me that you're trying to let even dumb people understand cryptocurrency. Well done. That's very nice of you. Why would you bother?
That's a good question. I don't know why anybody writes a book now that I've experienced it myself. But I was approached by my now publisher, Tracy McDonald, last year, and she suggested that, you know, given all the hype around cryptocurrency and the lack of understanding, perhaps it was time to write a book. And so I did. And as you've suggested, I tried to make it as simple as possible. I think it's a very complicated subject. And everybody's tired of that guy. You know that guy who's at every dinner party and every braai. And all he can talk about is how the world is going to change and Bitcoin. And as a little bit of
by
an
the way,
antidote
the,
to
the,
all of
the,
that.
Those people were particularly proficient at displaying their cryptocurrency knowledge or lack thereof around December last year. They've gone all quiet. They've gone a bit quiet since then because you got into cryptocurrency so long ago, 2011, that pretty much you're still like 500 or 600% up on anything, even on the worst days. And guys like that who bought in December, they're still struggling to get back up there, and they think it's going to go back up there soon. They're hoping, they're praying, right?
Yeah, well, I happen to agree with them. I say, there's actually a story there because in 2011, when I sort of started getting into it, I was writing a story for FinWeek magazine for the cover about Bitcoin, and it had just hit $1 to a Bitcoin, and it was approaching $9. So, you know, it was steadily ramping up, and everybody told me it was a bubble. And I looked around for South Africans who were involved, and I found this group online that were mining Bitcoin and working with it back in 2011. And I remember having a discussion with one of the guys who was in Pretoria. And I said to him, you know, do you have Bitcoin available? And he said, yeah, I'll sell you. I've got like, you know, 1,000 of them. You can have them for, I don't know, you know, $5 a coin or something. Wow. And I said, no, it's fine. I'll pass it.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine if you'd bought 1,000 of those then? What would they be worth now? Have you thought about that?
Well, 1,000 times 8,000 at today's price. So a lot of money, $8 million, I guess.
Jesus. Yeah. And you could have got them for $5 a coin. Oh, man, that make me sad.
But I did start mining back then and playing around, and I think it was more of a fascination with the technology. You know, back then, I wasn't thinking about what it would be worth one day, but rather how cool it was that we had this decentralized currency that threatened potentially the nation state ultimately, but certainly our fiat currencies that we used before, and just offered something better. So it really was just a fascination with the technology. I don't think anybody back in 2011 was expecting to get rich from it.
So how did you get involved in the technology? I mean, how did you develop an interest in this right at the start?
I think it was a natural evolution from my interest in information science. You know, ever since I was a little kid, I was a kid in the 80s in South Africa, and I remember my dad coming home with our first Intel 8086 computer. Yeah. You know, that cost just about as much as our house, and I ripped this thing apart and was just fascinated. And of course, I think gaming is the big gateway drug into computing for most people in our generation.
Absolutely.
But I was just fascinated, especially by what happened when you plug computers into each other and created these information networks. And, you know, Bitcoin is just adds to that. It's money for the internet. It gives our information network an economy for the first time. And that in itself is fascinating.
When you started to look into cryptocurrency, you mentioned just a moment ago that for you it indicates that there'll eventually be an end to the nation state, and eventually we'll all just be able to trade freely and fairly with each other without having to have middlemen and banks and everything else. But there must have been some reason that you personally wanted to get involved in it, because from there on, it kind of became your career for a while. It became your career to develop apps around this stuff. What was the interest then? Because we all have high and mighty objectives, like, you know, let's disintermediate finance. But that couldn't have been what you were thinking when you started.
No, not at all. And I don't, you know, I don't think that Bitcoin is going to be the end of the nation state. I think we'll still have nation states for a very long time. But I think it threatens some of their power. So that fascinated me. Financial inclusion as a possible outcome here was also something that I found intriguing, you know, especially living in a country in South Africa where, depending who you ask, anything between 5 and 8 million of our citizens can't have bank accounts. Yeah. And I specifically say can't instead of don't, because the banking system doesn't want them. They don't earn enough money. They don't store enough value. And so they're sort of precluded from the digital economy. They can increasingly get online, but they can't do anything online because they can't spend money online, etc. And so Bitcoin, you know, blockchain don't care how much money you've got. It'll let you start a wallet with just a few rand in it. And we can get into, you know, the fees of Bitcoin and how that whole world is changing. But if we sort of look past what's happening today and imagine where it's going over the next 10 or 20 years, financial inclusion, I think, is something exciting. You know, having less power to people who don't deserve it is something that excited me. I've always been, you know, a little bit of a rebel. So yeah. when I see people who I don't think deserve what they have getting punched in the gut, that's mildly satisfying. And so put it all together along with the technology, which in itself is fascinating. And this idea that for the first time you could have things on the internet that were both digital and scarce. That wasn't something that was true until Bitcoin really got underway. You know, if I had a picture of a cat on my computer and I copied it for you, now there were two, and then you could copy it for a friend and now there were three. And so right. We always had this digital abundance from the very beginning. But for the first time, we had digital scarcity. I could send you something over the internet and I would no longer have it, and now it's yours.
Yeah.
While still being digital. And that in itself is mind-blowing.
That is incredible. And I suppose that's where the major mind-bending principle for many people comes in, because a lot of people are still struggling to get their heads around things like the blockchain and how it works and what its purpose is. But what you've just explained now is that if I copy and paste something 1,000 times on my computer, it's abundant, it's endlessly abundant, infinitely so. But it isn't true for cryptocurrency, and it isn't true for all these tokens. And that's where I think people are starting to understand now, digital scarcity is really what we're after. And you explained that to me about 2.5 years ago. I wish I'd listened more carefully, because I might have been able to start mining or investing in cryptocurrency at a time where really it was cheap as chips. But when you look at the interaction between yourself and maybe let's call it people who are involved in this new technology and the banks, what do you immediately identify as being the differences?
Well, I think for one, we don't need middlemen. We don't need third parties. When Satoshi Nakamoto, who is the inventor of Bitcoin, and nobody knows who he, she, or they were for sure. Mm-hmm. There are many pronouns, but we'll just apply those three. When Satoshi announced it with his white paper, he said that he's been testing a peer-to-peer digital cash that relies on no trusted third party.
Yeah.
And it's that last bit that's really the most important bit, because it means that we can go back to transacting the way we always did before central banks and nation states, etc., which is directly with each other. If I want to buy something from you, Gareth, I can send you some Bitcoin and then you can give me the product, and we don't need anybody else involved in the transaction. As opposed to when you go to a coffee shop now, for example, and pay with your credit card, you know, there's a credit card network involved. There's an issuing bank on that card. There's a receiving bank. There's, you know, yeah, the merchant has to have a special kind of bank account. There are fees that flow to all of these parties in between. It's a pretty messy process, even if we have managed to make it quite efficient. And there are a lot of hops involved in that process that just aren't necessary now that we have a technology with Bitcoin, where I can pay the coffee shop directly and the transaction is only occurring between me and the coffee shop. And so that really takes us back to the way we used to transact in, you know, know, our ancient history in tribal communities. That was how people transacted in ancient Mesopotamia, where they had little clay chip tokens to represent everything from pots of honey to stores of grain and lengths of rope. That's how people were transacting. Now, you know, of course, that didn't scale. So central banks and everything that came with them were handy in the medium term because they gave us a way to scale economies. Mm-hmm. But we now have something that delivers peer-to-peer transactions at scale. And that's incredible. It means that banks get disrupted, but it means that companies like Uber are threatened as well, because yeah. I can have an arrangement directly with the driver now without a middle party like Uber getting any money for providing that service in the middle. So it's the disintermediation of middlemen, which is always the story of innovation. And I suppose that's the most immediate effect of something like Bitcoin becoming very popular.
Well, those are the people who you said earlier you don't think necessarily deserve the money, because they're parasites to the transaction. They're sitting on top of it and not necessarily adding any value, right?
Well, you know, that's perhaps unfair in some
the
cases.
In the past, they certainly added value because they made it possible for us to do these transactions. Now, you've got to question whether or not they're still adding value.
Yeah, and you have to look at, you know, pieces of history like 2009, where our financial systems let us down quite badly. And if you were a taxpayer in America, seeing your hard-earned dollars going to banks to bail them out, mm-hmm. When they had conducted criminal activity and were receiving bonuses as a reward for it.
Yeah.
That suggests that maybe while the system has served us well as a whole, there are these points in history where it failed us quite badly and where actually it exploited, you know, your average person in the street. And so we have something better now. Horses were great, but we've got cars now, so we don't need them anymore. Our system of central banking, yes, it wasn't perfect, but it worked fine. It's we've got something better now. So, you know, whether it's newspapers that made way for digital media, or whether it's the death of radio and the rise of something like you doing, Gareth, we can't cry for the dinosaurs. And it's not necessary to say that the dinosaurs were cuck either. We just have something better now.
I love this book because you actually tell people how you can you explain to people how you could become your own bank.
Yeah, and that's quite a frightening prospect to most, because when you explore that to its full extent and you talk about how Bitcoin works and how you can store your own keys and be in control of your own financial universe, that's something that's scary. You know, we've all heard these anecdotal stories about the guy who lost his hard drive with all the Bitcoin on it and hired a team to go through a dump to try and find it. That whole idea that I can look after my own value, but if I lose my hard drive or lose my phone or lose this piece of paper, I'm going to lose it all. That's very scary to most people. Until you see the practical implications of what it means to store your own keys and your own value. For example, if you're using a hardware wallet, something like a Trezor or a Ledger device, which are now available in South Africa too, you've got a very secure offline wallet for your digital stores of value. And even if you lose that wallet, you haven't lost your store of value. These wallets require a PIN, and if you put in the PIN three times incorrectly, they wipe themselves out. So if they get stolen or lost, that's not the end of the world, because they have a seed that you can back up on paper in a safe somewhere, for example, or that mm-hmm. you can leave in a safety deposit box that can restore them on any compatible wallet anywhere in the world. You can even remember those seeds. They generally come in the form of 12 or 24 words, and if you can just remember those words, you can restore your Bitcoin or Ethereum or any other wallet that's associated with that seed anywhere in the world, which is also mind-blowing. We call them brain wallets when you just remember a seed and you're essentially storing your wallet in your brain. You can cross a border and be strip searched and nobody can know that you've got potentially billions of dollars stored in your brain, something better than a Swiss bank account. And so when you look at the practical implications of this, you know, iCloud backups through Apple, which of course are securely encrypted. If I lose my phone, I have a wallet on my phone that can be restored. I can just walk into the nearest Apple store and buy a device. So this idea of being your own bank doesn't need to be a scary one. You know, banks are very handy, for example, when somebody passes away, because you can come with a death certificate and go, I am so-and-so's son and I'd like to access their account, etc. So people worry about that too. But if you just think about it, it's very easy to leave, you know, if you've got 12 words, give four of them to three different people. And if something happens to you, so long as these three people or four people can get together, they can restore your wallet. You could leave, you know, seeds with lawyers, etc. So it doesn't matter what way you look at it. This idea of being your own bank works. It can be made pretty safe. And it's something that I would challenge anybody listening to this to at least explore, even if it's just with 10 Rand. Find out what it means to actually look after that value yourself and not rely on a bank. And I suspect you will catch the virus, as have I.
Do you do any formal banking anymore?
Of course I do. I mean, you can't live in 2018 without a bank account. So yes, I am still very much involved in the traditional banking world, and a lot of the traditional banks are my clients. And I think what inspires me in a lot of cases is that, you know, for the most part, the old world of money isn't looking at Bitcoin necessarily as just a threat and something that'll kill them and trying to combat it. They're actually looking at how they can work with this technology and get involved in the game. And so there are a lot of interesting things coming from that as well.
I love this quote that you put in at the beginning of one of the chapters. I think it's the last chapter in your book, Naval Ravikant, where you said Bitcoin, or not you, he said, Bitcoin is a tool for freeing humanity from oligarchs and tyrants dressed up as a get-rich-quick scheme. Everybody seems to be very interested in what the value of Bitcoin is now and how you could, you know, take a couple of dollars and turn it into thousands of dollars if you just time it right. But that's not the real value. Blockchain is at the back of all of this. And what the blockchain does is it gives you truth. It gives you an honest and incorruptible technological backbone for us to determine what value really is. And I suppose this is what I'd like you to explain to me and to everybody else. Blockchain technology can be used in so many different places. What is it as a very basic principle, and how do you see it being rolled out to stop tyrants and despots and to help people free themselves?
So the blockchain technology is fascinating in and of itself, and essentially it's a way for computers to prove that they've done something. So it was it sort of evolved from a technology called Hashcash that was suggested in the 90s, and was designed to get around the spam problem with email on the internet. So it was a system that essentially came up with digital stamps for email. So could prove that it was the computer that sent this email. And also it required computers to do a little bit more work to send an email message than they did in the past, which meant that more resources were required, made it a little bit more expensive, and meant that if you were a spammer trying to send out a million messages at the time, your life would become hell because it would just be slow and expensive. And also you'd have to get around the encryption to prove that you were actually the sender of that email. So if you were trying to be somebody else, that would be impossible too. And so we got this idea that computers could stamp things and that they could prove that they had sent it, digital signatures, and they could prove that a computer had done some piece of work. And that's what gave us this idea of digital scarcity. But I do also feel that in this whole discussion of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, a little bit too much attention is given to blockchain technology. Yes, it's an amazing piece of technology and it enables incredible things. There are alternatives to it. Things like hashgraphs have been proposed. There's a network called the Tangle that powers a cryptocurrency called IOTA, so there's no blockchain involved in that. But what excites me more about Bitcoin is the story that it presents us with. It really gives us a better story to tell about money. And it's that narrative that I think gives Bitcoin its real power. And so when I say I think Bitcoin is still the most important cryptocurrency and probably will be for years, I think it'll beat out the others, etc., that has nothing to do with technology and very little to do with blockchain, and has more to do with the narrative of Bitcoin, the story of Bitcoin, right, which is always what makes better good technologies win. The classic example that, you know, is touted by futurists every time they talk about it is VHS versus Betamax. And those of us growing up in the 80s and 90s will remember going to a thing called a video store, kids.
Yep.
And we actually used to go and get movies on a piece of magnetic tape that was in a box of plastic, and then we put it into another box of plastic, and it was a mess. But Betamax was one of the options for storing video on tape, and it was better than VHS. But VHS won because it was slightly cheaper. The quality wasn't as good as Betamax, but it was good enough. VHS machines were the first ones to have wireless remotes, et cetera, et cetera. Long story short, it told a better story than the other technologies out there.
Right.
So there are myriad cryptocurrencies, and some of them are technologically superior to Bitcoin, or theoretically.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't matter because Bitcoin's got a better story. And that story is one about personal empowerment, about financial inclusion. It's one that doesn't rely on the cult of personality. There's no Steve Jobs in the Bitcoin world because nobody knows who Satoshi Nakamoto is. So, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto is immortal and will never die in a car accident. There was a rumor last year that Vitalik Buterin, who is the founder of the Ethereum cryptocurrency, had died in a car crash and the price plunged overnight. So,
given that
money is a game we play and it's a mythology that we all invest in, Bitcoin offers us the most compelling alternative to that. And it's one in which governments need to try a little bit harder to get tax money from us. They actually need to compel us to pay it because they don't have control over the banking system as they do with central banks, where they have to work a little bit harder and actually show us some value in order to get their tax returns. And where they don't have as much power as they do today because, and this is where we get into the philosophy and the ideology, I think governments have a little bit too much power at the moment. They almost always use it for the wrong reason and very seldom use it for the right reasons. So it's that story, Gareth. It's a better way of being.
I love that. I love your book, In Math We Trust. This is not the kind of book that people need to think hard and long about buying. It's there. It's available. It's not long. You could digest 151 pages very, very quickly, and it's fascinating. Simon, congrats, man. I've obviously known you a long time, and it's really great to see how well you're doing and how much you're making sense of all of this stuff for the rest of us. And I think it's terrific. All these apps you've developed are going to make our lives easier. All these things that you've been involved in and the stories that you tell are the kinds of things that we want to hear. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Gareth. It's always nice chatting to you, and thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we'll also be launching a cryptocurrency, like an idiot's guide to cryptocurrencies and to the whole world of what this digital disruption means. And Simon will be hosting them. They'll come up very, very soon on cliffcentral.com. I'm looking forward to that too.
So am I.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Thank you so much, man.
Cool. Thanks, Gareth. Right. Cheers.
Thanks, Simon. Then get the book. It's called In Math We Trust, The Future of Money.
This is CliffCentral.com.